There's a book that's just hit the stands, and if you're like me and have been part of this guy's life for the past 20 or 30 years, John Farnham, Jeff Apter is back with a great book to follow up the Bee Gees from last year. It's Playing to Win, the definitive biography of the man himself, John Farnham. And Jeff, another great tome, can I say. Well, it's not a tome, but it's a darn good read. I did it in one sitting, mate.
Oh, look, it's hefty enough, you know. You can use it for a doorstop, no problem, but I prefer you read it first.
I love the back.
How are you?
Farnsey, I mean, teen idol, king of pop, voice of the common man, Australian of the Year, friend icon, superstar. You really can't say much more about John. He is just the everyday Australian. When you think of prominent Aussies, he is one of them, isn't he?
Yeah, totally. I mean, as I worked on this book, I realised what he is, he's a regular bloke in an irregular job. That kind of sums it up in one sentence, I reckon, because I think he's probably the most grounded and down-to-earth character I've ever written about, you know. And let's face it, when you're in the pop world, your head can swell up like a balloon sometimes. But my understanding and what I came up with is the fact that he's surrounded by people who keep bringing him back to earth.
Yeah.
If that ever eventuated, which I don't think it has very often. But
well, he's like most of us, a working class upbringing. There's no major scandals in his family. His childhood wasn't filled with trauma. Here's a solid guy who started off with a really, you know, really good background and, you know, loyal parents. Solid friends.
Yeah, well, loyalty's an interesting, and that's a kind of recurring theme of the book, is that John was probably, in some instances, too loyal to certain people. Like his first manager, a guy called Daryl Samble, who was a really flamboyant character and got John noticed and got John to that position he was around the time of Sadie. But he also kind of invaded John's life almost. You know, he'd turn up at the doorstep at 1 o'clock and John would be with his then fiance. And, of course, when John announced quite early on in 1973 that he was going to be married, and Daryl had a meltdown. It's like, you can't get married, you're a pop star.
Do you think something was there with Daryl hoping that it would develop into something with John?
Of course. I mean, you know, it's a classic. There's a lot of, how can I put it?
It was the era.
Yeah, it was. And look, you know, falling in love with your star is not necessarily a good thing for anyone's career. It can be pretty dangerous. But Daryl got him to that position. He really did. Daryl understood hype before the word even existed. You know, that's how I kind of encapsulated the guy. And he did a great job, but he just got too emotionally wrapped up in everything John, you know. And ultimately, the funny thing is, if you look at John's career after he got married in 1973 and right through to probably about 1980 when he recorded Help, Daryl was kind of right. His commercial career flatlined after that.
Yeah,
so
there's a
bit of validity in that idea that as soon as a pop star, like a teen idol, gets married, all their fans' attention is going to turn somewhere else because they're suddenly not available.
Yeah, well, and this is before social media. You always needed some sort of scandal to be continually fed to the press, and happening in the early 80s. But it all changed when Glenn Wheatley took on John, or was it the other way around? How did that come about?
Yeah, no, that was, well, it's kind of a mutual admiration, if you like. They were friends. You know, John dined out and still dines out on this story that he and Glenn were sharing a house when they were in their early 20s, and it was Glenn's 21st. And it was a big day, and they were having a few drinks, and Glenn's mum, at that time Glenn was playing, I think, in the Masters Apprentices, and Glenn's mum had sent him a bottle of Great Western. Now, if you're as old as me, Great Western was the tipple of choice, you know. Young man.
Spew-manty.
Oh, yeah. But unfortunately, he'd left it in the back seat of the car, and it was January, and it was getting pretty warm. But, you know, after a few drinks, they decided to drink it. But anyway, and Glenn, unfortunately, had most of it and spent the rest of the day with his head down the toilet bowl. And John said that he saved him from drowning in the toilet bowl.
And see, and there's great stories like that in the book, Jeff, talking about drowning. We know both of them at various times in their career went through their financial difficulties.
Absolutely.
Wheatley was the one who funded Whispering Jack, the one that really got Farnsey back to mainstream Australia in the mid-80s. And then Vicky Verka, when Glenn's financial issues were causing him, I mean, he was jailed, we know that, for a time. Then John was there to help him. This is where loyalty and mateship, you know what, that really stands out as John's the sort of guy you'd love to have by your side, who's got your back, but he probably does need a bit of pushing though, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, to really sum up that relationship between the two, when John first signed with Glenn in 1980, John's career was really at rock bottom. He was playing, you know, suburban clubs. No one was interested in him. No record company would touch him. But Glenn knew that he was Australia's best singer and probably Australia's best entertainer, you know, in a mainstream way. And Glenn said to him, what do you need to get back on your feet? And John, a little sheepishly, because he didn't want to ask for a, you know, handout, he said, look, I need about $50,000. And Glenn wrote him a check. And he said, it's not a loan. It's just something to keep you going.
An investment, okay.
Fast forward 20-odd years, and Glenn's gone through this whole drama with the tax department and also losing millions of dollars on a Melbourne club, which turned out to be an absolute money trap. John sat down with Glenn at lunch one day, and he said, you know, Weets, how bad is it? And he said, well, you know, I'm broke. And he said, hang on. And he wrote him a check for $300,000 on the spot. You know, obviously their fortunes had changed considerably. This was the early 2000s. But it's a real reflection of the kind of bond between the two. You know, the money was never a case of, well, you better pay me back. It was more just, you helped me so much 20-odd years ago when I was absolutely... John couldn't even afford to take his son out to McDonald's for dinner. He was that broke in the 70s and 80s. And that was
almost a similar story with Darryl Braithwaite, who was working on a road gang before his album in 1990.
It's amazing, isn't it? There's a really interesting study to be made about what happens after you peak as a pop star and how you can rebuild your career, which is, you know, what John and Glenn Wheatley ultimately did. And Darryl did that too, of course, with, you know, Rise and Horses and all that great music that he made.
It's amazing too, in Playing to Win, you talk about just how big a phenomenon John Farnham is. And look, overseas, no one would really know the name unless they were sort of associating him with LRB, and that's a whole other story you're covering there. But as Stevie Nicks from Fleetwood Mac found, John Farnham was just too big even for her, and she actually, did she storm off stage or something occurred between them that...
See, John's done these interesting double headers over the years, you know, with Tom Jones and Lionel Richie and Olivia Newton-John, but they're not, you know, John opens and then the main act comes on. They've always shared the stage. Whereas with Stevie Nicks, it was very much, you're in Australia, John, you're the opening act, and I come on last. You play for X amount of time. I think it was an hour.
Yeah.
I get to play for as long as I want. But the rules kept getting changed because the first night of that tour, I think it was in Brisbane, John went on and in, you know, 45 minutes, absolutely had the crowd in the palm of his hand. And then Stevie came out and played all this new material that no one knew. So, you know, of course, the reviews the next day were talking about how great John was and, frankly, how dull Stevie was. And, you know, she blew a gasket and tried to continually change things. You know, you're playing for less and less time. I'm playing for longer and longer. And then ultimately, by the time they got to New Zealand, they'd reversed it and Stevie was opening for John. You know,
what was the phrase you used in the book? Stevie Nicks compared John Farnham as
It's like, oh, I'm playing with the Sinatra of Australia.
Yes.
No one told me that.
Great compliment.
It is. It wasn't quite what she was expecting. But like I say, you know, if you look at those other bills that he's played over the years, those double bills, they've always been shared headline. You know, Tom Jones, Lionel Richie and so on. They've
Shannon
always
Noel
shared...
next January.
Sorry?
Shannon Noel next January.
And Taxi, right? Don't forget Taxi. So, you know, he's really got a lot of international respect. He's just never had huge commercial success. Although I will say You're the Voice was a huge hit in the UK, Europe, and places like South Africa. You know, really odd spots, but just not in America.
Only the other day I noticed there was a heavy metal version of You're the Voice done by some group. That's how big this song is.
You're right. I think it's one of those Scandinavian metal bands, the types that you see on Eurovision.
That's right. Now, interesting, I love the title you use on your book, Playing to Win, because now... A lot of people debate me about this. Playing to Win, people say, oh, that's the John Farnham song. Strictly, it was an LRB song. And LRB with John Farnham really changed without the whole Shorrick business. And
they did.
I don't think John ever felt comfortable being part of that band, though, did he?
No. Well, I think the problem was that John loved LRB. He'd seen them with Glenn Shorrick out front. He'd seen them play in Las Vegas to a crowd of, you know, 10,000 people who were just screaming out for songs, and they knew every song, and the crowd response was just euphoric. And John had never encountered this before, and he Wheatley was there, and he said to him, Glenn, you know, what's this all about? And he said, people in Australia just have no idea how big LRB is. And this was mid to late 70s, you know, they were absolutely at their commercial peak. But by the time John was recruited into the band, things had started to slide a bit. You know, they were part... That soft rock era of the 70s when people, you know, Hotel California was everywhere and LRB were everywhere too. But that sound, you know, as happens in popular music and mainstream music, it got superseded by other things. And by the time John got there, they were, I wouldn't say they were yesterday's news, but they were just starting to fade in popularity.
Yeah, yeah.
The record company in America wasn't happy with the fact that that Glenn Shorrock had been dumped. John was trying to establish himself. You know, he was also trying to establish himself as a performer internationally. And there's a lot of friction within LRB, as John discovered. You know, the song Playing to Win is a perfect example of his relationship. He was really frustrated with, you know, all this infighting in the band. You know, John would play a show, and then afterwards a couple of band members would give him notes about his performance.
Oh,
you know,
really?
Stuff like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. John liked to get into the crowd, you know, but they shortened his microphone cable without telling him. And one night he did his usual run into the crowd, and he got to the edge of the stage and just pulled up like a lassoed horse. I was like, what's this? So anyway, John went away and wrote this song, Playing to Win, and it was supposed to be like a mission statement, if you like. This is a great band. We could still do great things. We've just got to, you know, combine our forces. We've got to be a unified force. So John wrote this song and took it into the studio, and unfortunately, in typical LRB fashion, everybody in the band had a go at it, picked it apart, changed the lyric here, changed the melody there. And by the time they got it out of the studio, although it still stands as a great, great song and one that John still performs, he only had 55% ownership of the song.
Yeah,
you know, someone else had 12%. It was ridiculous. It was crazy. So I thought it was a really strong title and a really representative of John's tricky relationship with LRB, but that, of course, led him on to Whispering Jack. So it was a very big turning point in his life.
Yeah, and the rest is history, as they say. We had the Chain Reaction album. We had the Age of Reason album. And look, we had, remember that big tour where he was saying goodbye to Australia. He started out in Cahoona,
where he met Daryl Sample.
Exactly. Yeah. And I still remember there's some YouTube footage of some of that behind the scenes stuff where Farnsey's about to go on stage and someone's, you know, put a camera and had a quick chat with him through the fence, and that's up there to have a look at. This is what I love, is that a lot of the examples you put in your book can be seen on YouTube. You can see some of the interviews and what have you, but there's so much more insight in Playing to Win, Jeff, and you got another winner on our hand, mate. I love it.
Oh, no, I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure to write. And look, I learned a lot about him myself. I must admit, I came in with what I thought was a good knowledge of John Farnham, and I came away with my eyes wide open to what this guy had been through and how he's managed to stay at the top for 30 years. Well, 50 years, I guess, if you start at 80. You know, it's an amazing ride. It really is.
And he still does 80 on stage, even though all through the show he says, I'm not going to do it, and right at the end he'll always slip it in. So.
You know, there's a great comment. I saw him play last December. He played at one of the final shows at the Sydney Entertainment Centre, which was, you know, Sydney's premier venue for years and years and years. John had played there 77 times, I think it is.
Wow.
And this is a, you know, 12,000-seat arena. John was playing, you know, the crowd was doing their usual chants for Sadie, and he's like, 20 minutes into his set, he said, look, he said, I'll play it, but I just want to explain something. He said, you know, I don't hate this song. You know I'm very resistant to playing it. He said, I understand exactly what it did for my career and how it got me started and how it's still the song that means so much to so many people. He said, but I've just recorded better ones.
Well, I mean, look, I go back to some of these 60s fandom, like One, which are okay songs, but they certainly don't stand up to, maybe it's production techniques, but his stuff from, I think from when he did that version of Help, which still blows me away.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I think he became more confident. He realised he wasn't a pop star as much as he was a singer, you know, and a song interpreter. And that's how I see him now, more like sort of like a Tom Jones or...
Joe Cocker,
that's a really good analogy.
Interpreter of great songwriting, yeah.
That's absolutely right. I mean, John has written some great songs, but he's not a prolific songwriter. But you give him a song that he really connects with emotionally, and Help is a classic example of that.
And look what he did with Jesus Christ Superstar, brought that show to a new audience in the early 90s. That was brilliant.
Okay, there's one funny story about that I do like to relate, is that John was reluctant to do JC Superstar because... What was it, 1992?
But he looks like him.
Yeah. I mean, but the symbolism is fantastic. I mean, his career had gotten to the point, the only person he had left to play was Jesus. You know, he'd gotten that high. But Harry M. Miller was the driving force for this, and he said, John, you've got to do it. I want to bring it back on the stage, because Harry had done it back in the 70s. And John was like, oh, look, I feel like I'm a bit old for the part, and I'm not sure if I want to do something as demanding as this. And Harry said, look, John, it's fine. I'll light you gently, and all you've got to do is pinch Mary Magdalene's bum every night.
Oh, Kate Sobrano, yes. So John, good.
John reluctantly agreed, and of course the rest is Australian theatrical history. I think it's the most successful production we've ever put on in this country.
Now, Jeff, have you had any feedback from John Farnham himself on this book yet?
I can safely say I've spoken to someone who is as close to him as you'll get. Mm-hmm. And Glenn Wheatley did call me at one point when I sent him the manuscript, made sure that he read it and understood what was there, and he said, I think, while John will never endorse this, I think you've written the most real and honest and just believable portrait of this guy. Mm-hmm. And from someone who's known this guy for 50 years, that was real high praise. So I was really satisfied with that.
Get hold of it now. Jeff Apter's latest work. It's Playing to Win, the full biography of John Farnham. And we all love him. And if you want to know more, this has some good insights into his struggles, his childhood, and where he ends up. And I love how the book doesn't have a definitive end. Just we don't know, I don't think his career will end. When he dies, I think Australia will die, you know?
Yeah, look, I think he probably regrets calling an album The Last Time, that's for sure. Because, look, I think he just enjoys it. You know, he doesn't overexpose himself these days. He comes out every couple of years and does a tour, might do a new record every 3 or 4 years. He does stuff that he wants to do, and there's no reason why he couldn't continue doing that until, you know, into another 10, 15 years. Who's to say?
John Apter, thank you for your time.